Well, Lee Masters, thank you so much for doing this. We are talking about your time at Wacky in Louisville. Let's talk a little bit, though, about the time before you came to Wacky. How did you get started in radio, and what stations did you work at before you came to the Super 79?
Well, I started my career when I was 15 years old on the air in Doylestown, Pennsylvania, at a daytimer, WBUX 1570. I did that when I was in college at Temple University. I worked at a country station in Philadelphia, WRCP. And then I got a gig in Wilmington, Delaware at WAMS, W-A-M-S. And I was working midnight to 6 on that station and then driving up to Philadelphia to take my classes during the day. Did that for a year, actually, and then actually got moved up to do the night show, and that's when I became very tough on my schedule to go to college and work doing that shift, so I stopped going to class. Then I went to Indianapolis, and I worked at WIFE, and I was like 71 to 72, and in fall, September of 72, I had the offer to go to work for Wacky.
Was that a tough offer to take up?
Well, not really, even though, you know, as a market size at the time, there were, you know, comparable markets, and both stations were kind of market leaders. It was a no-brainer for me because Wacky had such a great reputation as being a personality radio station, and that's what I really enjoyed doing. And I thought, you know, for me to have the opportunity to work on a radio station with all these great guys that really had fantastic, outsized personalities would be wonderful for me, a great working experience, a great learning experience. And it was a no-brainer. It wasn't a tough decision to make, and it was all about working for Johnny Randolph and working with the incredible team there.
Now, what shift did you do when you came to Wacky?
It was a weird shift. It was 9 at night till 2 in the morning. It was a 5-hour shift, and the first 4 hours were music, and then there was a talk show because we needed to have public service programming. There was a talk show that we ran from 1 o'clock till 2 o'clock in the morning every day, and I did that as well. So I did talk radio for the first time in my life.
That probably helped you become a better jock on the air.
I don't know, but I guess it depends on your perspective, because it was interesting just, you know, being able to open the microphone and talk, although I did almost no preparation for that, and it certainly showed.
Did you get lots of calls?
There was never a struggle getting phone calls. Wacky was a very successful radio station with a huge audience, and so I just don't remember ever having a hard time getting response. I don't even know if I ever gave any more thought than when I sat down to talk about what the topic was going to be. But I don't remember having any problem getting the calls.
Now, I guess you came on after Coyote Calhoun, and before who?
Coyote came after I was there. Jason O'Brien was doing nights when I got there, I think. He was doing 6 to 9.
And who was the all-night guy at Wacky?
And then the all-night guy, I'm trying to think, I'm blanking here.
Kevin McCarthy, maybe?
Kevin McCarthy, I'm sorry, Kevin McCarthy, exactly. Did overnights, but I don't know if he was there when I started there or whether he came later. See, I worked at Wacky twice.
Oh, really?
I worked there from fall of 72 to the fall of 74, and then I went to Y100 in Miami, and that did not work out very well. I was only down there for like 4 months, and I came back and I worked at WLRS as a jock doing album rock. That would have been in summer of 75, and then I went to Europe and hung out for a while. I came back in the fall of 75, and then I worked middays at Wacky for a very short period of time, like 6 months. And then I went back to work at LRS as program director. So I worked at Wacky twice. So it was a different configuration each time.
Now, did you leave Wacky the first time just because Miami was a step up?
Well, it was a great step up financially for me. It was a step up in market size. You know, one of the things I really learned from my Wacky experience was what a great place it was to work, and working for Johnny Randolph was a terrific thing. He was a great guy. He encouraged people to try things. He provided a wonderful environment for being creative and being a personality. And then I went to work for Y100, which was a hugely successful radio station at the time. But it was really one of those Wacky, to use a different term, fits, because I didn't really fit in to the sound that they had there. There's a very, very teen kind of sounding radio station and very, very young sounding jocks. And I did not fit in at all. It was not a fit on any level. And very little personality allowed.
How did you go from the 9 to 2 shift on Wacky to afternoons when Burbank left?
Exactly, yes.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about the very famous, it's one of the most famous air checks out there of Gary Burbank's last show on Wacky, where he has himself shot. And it's a real classic as far as air checks go. Now, what was your part in all that?
Well, we worked on it together. Obviously, Gary was the creative genius behind it. You know, he had come up with this idea, this notion that in leaving, he had to do something other than just, you know, very maudlin goodbye show, farewell. And he came up with this great stunt. And I just remember sitting in the production room and working on that with him and pre-recording most of it. And I remember the big fight. The funny thing was, even back then, you know, 31 years or so ago, Johnny was very, very concerned about the legal implications of what we were attempting to do, and he insisted that we do a disclaimer before he did the bit. You know, the following is pre-recorded, or the following is an enactment or something. I forget what the exact language was that he wanted, but he insisted that we do it, and we did it, and I believe he came in the control room and said, you know, that's not enough. That's not enough of a disclaimer. He was very upset. So right in the middle of this bit, or right as the bit was beginning, we had to say again very clearly, you know, the following is an enactment or dramatization or something of that sort. So, you know, we were livid. We were, like, really upset because we thought that's going to completely screw it up. But the truth is no one heard that. Everybody heard the bit. As for what they thought it was, and people used to say that they were pulling over on the side of the road, they couldn't believe what they were hearing. No one heard the disclaimer at all, even though it was very prominent twice. It was a lot of fun, and it was very typical of the station. It was very typical of Gary and the stuff he did, and very creative, and a fun way to make the transition from one of us doing the show to the other one. But at that point, I might have been doing nights because, you know, if Gary was signing off and I was coming on after him, I might have moved from 9 to 2 to tonight. I just don't even remember anymore.
That must have been about the time that Coyote Calhoun came on board.
That's when Coyote came. Then I did afternoons and Coyote did nights. And we did that for a long time. And to make matters, you know, even funnier, we were roommates for a long period of time. So we shared an apartment in Louisville. It was a wild place.
How would you describe it if you were trying to tell somebody about the Lee Masters Show at night and in the afternoon at Wacky today? What was it all about other than just playing records and having fun?
Primarily what I did was very short bits. It was more like, hopefully, clever asides, very quick quips, plays on word. You know, I'd make really quick comments about the music or current events, things of that sort. But they were all very fast, almost thrown-away lines. That's kind of what I liked. Kept it moving, tried to keep it fast, kind of up-tempo. I never stopped to do long bits or long jokes.
Other than the Gary Burbank getting shot bit, did Johnny Randolph, do you remember him ever saying, Lee, I'm sorry, that's too close, or that's really not right?
No, I don't remember Johnny ever doing that. Johnny was always very encouraging. That was one of the great things about working for him and developing as a talent. He always encouraged people. He always encouraged me. I was playing around with different sounds at the time, trying to get away from the typical deep voice disc jockey thing and not worrying about how deep my voice was and having a more natural sound and talk to Johnny about the, what do you think, Johnny? And he's, yeah, that's a great idea. He was always encouraging all of us to try different things and to grow and find our own voice.
WKLO was also a very good top 40 radio station in Louisville at the time. Wacky almost always won, and I know that they were the leader in the 70s. Why do you think that WKLO was never able to beat Wacky? I mean, after all, they had twice the power, although the frequency wasn't nearly as good.
Well, they did beat Wacky a couple of times. And, you know, during that period of time, and it was a real wake-up call. In fact, Coyote and I joke about it. I got together with Coyote and Burbank. We had dinner together in Cincinnati. I'm on the board of a company based in Cincinnati now, so I get there, and we all got together and had dinner there and had some drinks and told old war stories. We hadn't all been together for many, many years. When Bill Hannis was program director at KLO, it was very, very formatted, very tight. They had, you know, the Drake Chenault jingles, and it was a very tight playlist. The jocks couldn't say very much. It was very up-tempo. And they actually really put it to Wacky, you know, for at least one or two books. And then when I moved to afternoons and they brought Coyote in, we almost had our own playlist. We might have had at the time 30 or 40 records on the playlist. And I don't even know if Johnny knows this now, but we used to just cull through the playlist and pull records from the stack so that the list that Coyote and I were playing, we were probably playing 20 records rather than the standard playlist of 30 or 33 records. And we did the same thing with oldies. We had this massive oldies library, and Coyote and I had our separate little bins that we pulled all these cartridges of the super hot, highly requested oldies or recurrents, and there might have been 50 of them or 100 of them. And we used to just, the two of us, from 2 in the afternoon till 10 o'clock at night, we had this ridiculously tight playlist that we concocted ourselves. If anyone had ever tried to do that anywhere else, they would have been fired. I'm sure if Johnny knew, he would have ripped us apart, but we did that in our own weird way to combat KLO and had terrific success doing it. But they did beat Wacky, you know, a couple of times.
Why do you think they weren't consistent at it? I mean, once you guys shortened the playlist and got the music right.
I think people really do prefer personality, and it was a very entertaining, fun radio station to listen to, and I think that made it much more enjoyable for people to listen to. But if you're not playing the right music, that's not enough on its own. So when we cleaned the playlist up and tightened it up, that made a big difference.
Okay, I'm going to run some names past you, some folks that have worked at Wacky about the time that you did, and tell me whatever comes to mind.
Okay.
Bill Bailey.
Well, Bill was great. He was absolutely fabulous. You know, I never hung out with him very much. I mean, he was doing mornings, I was doing nights, so we didn't really have a chance to socialize. And there was such a difference in age as well. But I loved listening to him on the radio. It was in an era before, you know, what's now known as the shock jocks. Bill was really probably the most out there guy in the country at that particular point. He was really doing some outrageous stuff, and he was fun to listen to. You just never know what to expect. He was shocking. But again, it was a real treat for me. The one real joy, one of the many joys, I should say, of working at Wacky at that time was you could turn the station on any time of the day or night, and it was so motivating and inspiring because you couldn't just show up and phone it in. Because everybody else on the station sounded so damn good. It really made you want to do a better job. It did for me. It really inspired me.
What about Dude Walker?
Great voice, smooth as can be. He was always just tight, very concise, followed the format, and he sounded like $1 million, and he was very consistent that way.
Gary Burbank.
To this day, listening to Gary, I don't know how he does the voices, how he does them live. It's, you know, his voice and the voice of the characters, you'd swear, are overlapping. It sounded like it then, it sounds like it today. And I had never heard anybody doing that kind of radio before Gary. There was a situation because, you know, the time slots we were on and less of an age difference, we used to spend a lot of time hanging out, and it was so much fun. He's just a great guy, very smart, very talented, and we had a ball. It was so much fun listening to him. You know, without a doubt, one of the most talented personalities ever on the radio. Terrific guy.
Okay, Coyote Calhoun.
You know, hilarious. A wild man. He had so much energy on the air. What he used to do on the air was just jump through the speaker, and it was a scream. And he used to get these joke services and tell the silliest, corniest jokes over the intro of Top 40 songs and howl and scream and yell. And I mean, it made the station just sound outrageous. I mean, it was wild to have all of that going on the same radio station.
I remember the famous Lee Masters girlfriend jokes.
Yeah, he always did those.
Did you have a girlfriend at the time?
I had many. I had many. And
once they heard the jokes, they were gone, huh?
They didn't stick around too much. He was speaking generically, but it was always fun to be kind of the butt of his jokes.
Tom Dooley.
Didn't work with him the first time when I came back, we worked together. I grew up in the Philadelphia area, so the big Top 40 station I grew up listening to that kind of inspired me was WFIL. And Dooley had worked there, you know, at one point. So I knew him from that. Again, incredible voice, great pipes, smooth, and really know how to make the format sound like $1 million.
Anybody I'm forgetting from your time there?
Bailey, Dude Walker, Johnny was on the air. Johnny did a great job. He did a two-hour shift. Very natural sounding. You know, this is in an era where everybody was trying to make their voice as deep as they could. And Johnny was, I think, one of the first guys to really try to sound as natural and as real as he could. And I thought he always sounded very friendly, warm, you know, great presentation. Gary was on, then Jason, me, you know, then it was Kevin. And, of course, as I said, it changed when Gary left and I moved to afternoon and Coyote came in.
Why do you think that Wacky is remembered as fondly as it has been?
There are two answers to the question. One is a more general and the other specific. Generally, I think if you go to any market in the United States, I think people from that era remember very fondly the station they grew up with in that area. I don't think that differs in too many markets. What I think is different about Wacky is it was such a different radio station in that it wasn't just about talking on the radio or being able to talk a lot, because there's a difference between that and personality. In many of the stations of that era, the jocks talked a lot, but they really weren't what I would deem personalities. Wacky really was a station with an incredible lineup of on-the-air personalities. And you have to give Johnny Randolph credit for not only being able to find them, being able to hire them, being able to create an environment where everybody felt good and inspired and wanted to do that every day and create great radio. And then putting the packaging, the music, the jingles, the wacky shouts, you know, the really wacky and wild contests, and being very local, all those elements together really made it a unique station. So I think it really is all about that personality. And you have to give the credit to Johnny for conceiving of it and hiring and putting together the incredible lineup of people that he had on the air.
Let's talk about Lee Masters after he left Louisville the second time. Well, after he left Wacky the second time.
Uh-huh.
You went to LRS and you were program director there.
Right. At that time, we were probably the most successful album rock station in the country. The interesting thing a lot of people don't know about it was it was a five-county metropolitan area. We had a Class A FM, 3,000 watts, 300 feet. We always thought there was kind of a lid on what we could do. But the second book I had there, we had a 12.8, and we beat everybody. It was pretty amazing. And I stayed there programming, I think, for about a year and a half, and then I left in 1977 to go to WNBC in New York. Bob Pittman, my friend Bob, we'd known each other since we were like 19 or 20. Bob was program director of WNBC and offered me a chance to go to New York, work at NBC, and I left and I did afternoons there, 77, and in 78 I did mornings at WNBC, which is, I'd never done a morning show before.
Now, where was Imus?
I like to tell people I was between Imuses.
Oh, okay.
Imus had been at NBC and then had been, in his words, kind of exiled to Cleveland, and that's when our group came in, and first Ellie Dillon, who was at WMAQ, did mornings at NBC, and that didn't work out, and they moved me from afternoons to mornings. And then I left to actually buy my first station with the Hensons, the people who owned WLRS, and Scotty Brink and Richard Belzer came in to do mornings on NBC. I don't know how long they were there, and then Imus came back. So there were three of us between Imus, Ellie Dillon, me, well, four, I guess, Richard Belzer and Scotty Brink together as a team. But I left in the latter part of 78 to come back, and the Henson family, who owned WLRS in Louisville, where I'd worked a number of times, we bought an AM-FM combination in El Paso, Texas, of all places, an FM country and a Christian AM station, and I moved from Manhattan to El Paso, Texas. I was probably 26 or 27 years old, and I bought my first two stations, and I was down there for a number of years managing those. And then we bought Wave in Louisville for an AM to match with LRS. I came back and programmed that and did an afternoon shift for a short period of time. So all in with the Hensons, I was partners with them for about 6 or 7 years. Then I moved to, of all places, Tulsa, Oklahoma, to manage an FM country station. Did that for 2 years, and then Pittman hired me again, first to run VH1, which I did for 6 months, and then I got a promotion when Bob Pittman left MTV Networks. The guy that was my boss, Tom Freston, took over as chairman, and I became the general manager of both MTV and VH1, and did that for 4 years. And that was from, it would have been 86 to 90, to 86 to 89. And then I had the opportunity to come out and turn around. The folks at HBO and some of the cable operators owned a startup company called Movie Time, which had about 8 million subscribers at the time, but really wasn't doing very much. It had about $2.5 million of revenue, all infomercials and such, and they asked me to take a look at it, and I came back with the notion of doing entertainment news all the time, and they were playing movie trailers pretty much as their programming, and we created E! Entertainment Television. I joined in January. We launched that network in June of 1990, and I stayed there for 9 years. Then one of our investors, Liberty Media, offered me the chance to create another public company, and we did Liberty Digital, which invested in cable networks and interactive television and internet technologies during the big boom in that sector. So that was a lot of fun. I did that for 4 years. So that's what I've been doing. Right now, I'm a director on a number of public companies. I also am a director on four not-for-profit boards. My wife and I created a family foundation a number of years ago, so we spent about 25 or 30% of my time doing not-for-profit work, philanthropy, about 25 or 30 or so percent on these public boards. I spend another 25% doing investment. I work with private equity groups, venture capital funds, buyout shops, making investments in media, traditional media or new media companies where I can have some kind of strategic input. The other time is spent doing a lot of traveling and goofing off, mountain biking, reading, hanging out, spending time with my kids. But it's a very flexible life, and I love it.
All right, here's a stupid question. Do you miss radio?
Do I miss radio?
As in, like, being on the radio, being on the air.
No. Because by the time I had done that, I had totally burned out on it. I would say this. I think had I continued to be able to work for somebody like Johnny Randolph in an environment where I could have been a personality and grown and been inspired by the people I worked with and for, I might have enjoyed it and stayed doing it. So in a weird way, thank God I didn't continue doing that. So that kind of motivated me to look for other things that were intellectually challenging. And so I got into the business side of it, which is, you know, a real boon for me. It's worked out, you know, incredibly well. But no, I don't miss that part of it. Now, I still am involved in radio to an extent, and this is what I get to do kind of with part of what my life is now as a director. One of my for-profit commercial ventures, XM Satellite Radio, I'm on the board of directors there. It's a fabulous company. I love satellite radio. I love the fact I can listen to, you know, 163 channels and not have to hear commercials and get to hear the most esoteric, narrow niche of music. So I love that business, and it keeps me kind of involved in the business on one hand. In my not-for-profits, I'm on the board of directors of one of the public radio stations here in Los Angeles, KPCC, which runs a lot of NPR programming and a lot of local news and information programming. So I get to keep my hands in it, but not as a disc jockey.
All right. Well, you wised up.
I don't know. I don't regret any of it, because it certainly was an awful lot of fun. I mean, I had a ball. I absolutely had a ball. Pittman and I was talking to Bob yesterday, and it's funny because his background is very similar, and so is Ken Lowe. One of the other boards I'm on is VW Scripps Company, and the CEO there is a guy named Ken Lowe, who's from North Carolina. And Ken, similarly, started out as a disc jockey and became a program director and a general manager. Now he's the CEO of the EW Scripps Company, which is a $7, $8 billion market cap media company. Very successful, cable networks, TV, Food Network, Home and Garden, television stations, newspapers, very large media company. And we scratch our heads and go, you know, I started out playing records. How did I end up here? It's pretty funny. I look at what I do now, which is basically investing, and it's hard to believe that I used to play top 40 records. You know, people say to me, how did you get that job? How did that happen?
Well, you were certainly at some great radio stations, Wacky, of course, being probably the best one as far as I'm concerned. But before we wrap up, I want to ask you about WNBC, because I'm somewhat interested in that station as well. Late 70s, I guess the station was trying to do the top 40 thing and trying to take on WABC. Did they get close?
The station improved a lot, but never overtook WABC.
Was that just because WABC was just so huge and was doing everything right?
I don't really know why we didn't. I was not close enough to the programming myself to know. You know, we were doing call-out research. They were not. I've heard people say that one of the reasons was there were such big personalities on that station at the time, and that's really hard to overcome the Dan Ingrams of the world and the Cousin Brucies of the world. The other argument was that because we were doing call-out research, we weren't urban enough, you know, to beat WABC. But the truth for me is I just don't even know. I don't know why we didn't.
Did you enjoy working there?
I enjoyed having been there. I enjoyed being in New York, because when I started at age 15, I said, I'm going to be in New York working for WABC or WNBC by the time I'm 25. That was the goal I set for myself. So by the time I was 25, I was there. So I was happy with that. I always wanted to work with an engineer, have somebody, you know, play the spots and run the music for me. I thought that would be a hoot to do. That was kind of neat. Bob and I did a television show together there called Album Tracks, which ran on the NBC-owned and operated TV stations in New York, Chicago, Washington, and I think L.A. We did that for about 12 or 13 weeks. And so that was a lot of fun. But actually being on the air in New York, it was a highly formatted radio station. We couldn't do much of anything on the air. It was incredibly boring for me. The music was selected, there was an engineer, and I wasn't allowed to do much. It was incredibly boring, so it was not challenging. And that is one of the things that kind of motivated me to get into management and try to be stimulated and challenged in other ways.
Could you tell me the story, for the record, that you told me the other day about Charles McCord and the crossword puzzles?
Sure. Well, this is my example of how bored I was. Charles McCord was doing news for me at the time. McCord had done for many years news for Don Imus and continues today to work with Don Imus doing news and helping him write a show. He's one of his writers. And Charles is an incredibly funny guy, an incredibly smart guy. He used to run a copy of the New York Times crossword puzzle every morning. He would take one copy, I would take the other, and I'd sit in the control room in the booth. He'd sit in the newsroom, and we would see who could do the New York Times crossword puzzle the fastest. And so, you know, a record would be fading out. It'd be the Bee Gees, Night Fever. I'd do my little intro, slam the next song on, get back to my crossword puzzle. And that's what I would do to keep myself busy.
That could be why WNBC never beat WABC.
It could very well be.
Because all the jocks were just bored out of their gourd because the format was so restrictive.
I don't know if the other guys were, but I sure was. So
WNBC was feeling the pinch of the AOR stations, of FM stations. We always play the long versions of your favorite songs, and we never talk over the introductions. Was that when you were there, or was that afterwards?
We always played the long version, so I know that. We ultimately did do it, but I think it was one of those things where at the very beginning we did not.
Boy, it's hard to run a tight, bright show and not do that.
I know. But we were trying to differentiate. We wanted the station to be differentiated. We wanted to. There was a lot of concern about FM at the time, and you know, could we play really the music people wanted to hear and not be intrusive and be screaming and yelling over it? And at WABC, that's what they were doing. In retrospect, you know, who knows? Was it the right thing? I don't know. But it is true. It was not an exciting-sounding radio station.
Looking back on those companies that you were part of the startup for and how they've evolved today, VH1 and MTV certainly are very different animals than they were back in the 80s, and I guess probably true of E as well. But for VH1 and MTV, do you ever turn them on and go, man, why are you guys doing that? Or do you look at them and go, well, I'm proud that I started that and they're doing what's right?
Well, I don't watch any of them enough to offer any criticisms or praise one way or the other. I mean, I typically, and I did this in radio as well, when I was finished with a project, I rarely went back and spent much time with it. So I haven't watched VH1 or MTV or E very much in all the years since I've left. I might watch the Video Music Awards on MTV. Oh, for many years I went to it. After I left, I would go, and then I would watch it, and now I just don't seem to do that anymore. My kids watch it a little bit, but they seem to be more interested in Comedy Central than anything, which is run by Doug Herzog, and Doug worked with me. He was our head of production at MTV when I was there. But I take a lot of pride in it. It was a lot of fun to do. It was a kick. I loved it. All of them are incredible businesses today with huge audiences and huge revenues and massive cash flows. And all of them have had to evolve over the years to be more. Just playing music videos 24 hours a day wasn't enough to really keep MTV or VH1 growing. And we started putting the long-form programs on when I was there. We put on The Weekend Rock. We put on rockumentaries. We created Club MTV. The wildest thing that we did that was very controversial at the time was Remote Control, the game show. And that turned out to be a huge success. And then, of course, later, after I left, Beavis and Butthead came on, and The Real World, and Jackass, and all the other shows. And those shows perform far, far better than the music videos do. So I think probably some people look at it and go, why did they move away from music videos? And the answer is because it got more people watching and kept them watching longer. So it was a terrific business move. You know, one of the things about music videos I always explain to people who don't like the fact that there aren't videos on very much anymore is, you know, in the television business, like radio, it's not just how many people come in to the station, it's how long do they stay. It has to do with, on radio, time spent listening, and with television, it's time spent watching. And with music videos, people were making 3-minute, 4-minute decisions about how long they were going to stick around. I like that one, I don't like that one. And they'd come in, you know, they dial away when they saw something they didn't like. But when you start putting on half-hour shows, you know, giving them 30-minute decisions, or 1-hour shows, or 2-hour shows, people tend not to go away as many times, and you keep an audience longer, and that's been the greatest boon for the ratings, and that's why it's worked with all of those guys. But it was a treat to be involved with all of them, VH1, MTV, and E. Proud to have been involved, and I got to work with some amazing, very creative people at all three of those businesses.